Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Could Mars ever have sustained life? Answering that question was a primary goal for NASA's Curiosity rover mission, which has continued to send back clues to the history of the red planet, which may in turn help us understand the genesis of life on Earth. Many scientists are also hoping we can eventually put human beings on Mars to study it up close, although such a mission would require stunning investments of research time and money and potentially great sacrifices from the first human crews to make the trip. Science writer Mark Kaufman shares the latest scientific insights and some stunning images beamed back from the little red rover, in his new book. It's called Mars Up Close, Inside the Curiosity Mission. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
The question that occurred to me over and over as I read this book was, when you drop a single vehicle on another planet to begin exploring, how do you decide where to start?
Well, there was a long process, I think almost a decade long, where they, where NASA folks and other people in the Mars community, as it's called, would sift through the different possibilities. The Gale Crater, which is where they landed, was selected primarily because, one, it was an area that was large enough that they could land in, and two, it had this big mountain in the middle of it. And not only did it have this big mountain, but the mountain had layers, which from a geological perspective are just, you know, gold, because it is a way reading the layers is a way of kind of reading the history of Mars. So they went to a place that seemed to have the kinds of environments that could potentially have been habitable at one point. They also had determined that there were some minerals there that could only be formed in water. So there were four contenders, but this was the one that that clearly had all that was needed.
I hadn't realized what a massive achievement it was that Curiosity landed within such a small target area. Can you talk about why that kind of accuracy was such a triumph?
Oh, yeah. This is it was really stunning. They had what they call their landing ellipse was not very large. They had to land in this crater. It's a fairly large crater. It was like 90 miles across. But then you have this like 25-30 mile in diameter mountain in the middle. And what they needed to do was to get close to the mountain but not hit the mountain. And they had to get into the crater because if they were on above the rim of the crater – then they really couldn't find anything that they wanted because they couldn't go down. So yes, it was by far the most pinpoint landing ever. But it still is kind of a long way to go before they could think in terms of having the capability to land a human there, because they have to be really precise. You don't want to send a human land a capsule and then have the people have to go several miles to where you've laid out all their stores.
Hmm. How was Curiosity deposited safely on Mars and then opened for business?
They just a little bit of background. Curiosity is about a ton in weight, which is six times bigger than the other or heavier than the other rovers that have landed, and the previous rovers landed wrapped up in big balls. Seemed like a crazy way to land, but it actually was very safe. And they then, you know, after the ball came to a stop, they then drove out. Couldn't do it with Curiosity because it was too big. The ball wouldn't hold it. So they had to come up with a new technique, and it's called the sky crane. So, you know, here is this capsule coming in at 13,000 miles an hour as it hits the top of the Martian atmosphere, and it has 7 minutes to go down to zero. And that's not easy to do at all. And even though Mars doesn't have the same kind of atmosphere that we do, it has some atmosphere, which provided some of the braking. But what they had to do was do S-turns. They had a parachute that that slowed them down. And then at the end, they had this sky crane maneuver where they had a basically a hovering platform. It was something that had a number of rockets on it that kept it up in the air about 20 meters above the ground. And then it had four cords with which the rover was gradually, slowly put down onto the ground. And then, as if that wasn't hard enough, and you had to have this platform, which was slowly descending also, cut the cords and then fly off, or else it was going to land right on Curiosity, making it a very bad day.
It's also remarkable to think about all those scientists holding their breath for those 7 minutes, waiting for this thing to happen.
It was actually a really glorious moment. I had the good fortune to be out there at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and to see so many people so first, really anxious about it, but then so absolutely enraptured. What made it particularly surreal was that there's a 14-minute time gap between what happens on Mars and the news, the information that we would receive on Earth. So in this 7 minutes of terror where the capsule is going down, it was already like either safely on the ground or crashed somewhere 7 minutes into it. But people didn't know until the full 14 minutes later.
So the rover is called a rover, but to be clear, there are some limits to its mobility. Tell us about how far and how fast it can travel along the surface of the planet.
Sure. The speed is, it goes very slowly, and it is all of its movements are programmed here on Earth, and then it acts out or drives out the program during the next day. It has certain autonomous capabilities, and so can go to, say, 100 meters. And then if things still look kind of safe and there aren't too many obstacles around, then it can, on its own, continue on for a ways. The rover, alas, has had some difficulties with its wheels. It's gone over some very sharp rocks that were embedded into sandstone, and as a result of that, some of the wheels were punctured. Now, this is not anything that's a mission killer at all, but it did force the NASA folks to think long and hard, and what they came up with was, one, we're going to try to go over very few of these sharp rocks in the future, and two, we're going to drive backwards. Because it was the front and middle wheels that had all this damage. So the thing is now going backwards, except for when it turns around and does the autonomous driving after that initial driving for the day is done.
Early in the mission, Mark, NASA scientists got a hunch about what they might learn if they pretty radically altered the rover's original itinerary.
Yeah, this was one of those just great moments in planetary discovery and adventure. They landed with the clear mission of heading to the base of this mountain called Mount Sharp and looking at those layers that looked so amazingly promising. But as they were going to Mars. And then as they got closer, there were orbital images that were coming out of an area kind of near ultimately where they landed, where three different formations of rock came together. And something looked very unusual there. And the geologists, they can read these things from afar. So they landed and they said, not only is this a really unique kind of formation, but it appears to be the lowest point in the whole crater. So from a perspective of kind of following the water, which has been the NASA mantra for a long time, they said, at the bottom, the lowest point is where you're going to get water if there is some. So maybe we should change our plan. The original thought was that it would take a couple weeks, maybe a month or two at the most. But they drove this that way. It was probably a half a mile or so in the opposite direction to where they thought they were going to go. And they ended up spending a long time there, almost a year, and making probably the greatest discoveries that have ever been made on Mars.
Tell us about those discoveries.
Be delighted to. Much of Mars, that as we understand it, as we have seen it, is kind of hard scrabble. It looks, you know, there's a lot of volcanic material around. It doesn't look like it ever had water on it, although from orbit you could see some what appeared to be rivers. But in any case, once they got into this area that they named Yellowknife Bay, you could see that, you know, it looked kind of like an old dried up mud flat, and nothing like that had ever been seen on Mars. And it had all this layering, which again is sedimentary rock, and that means that it got carried there most likely by water. And they also made a discovery that there was indeed a stream slash river coming off the top of the crater wall down right into this area. They could determine that there were pebbles there that were rounded and could only be formed through the process of going down in a stream. And there was conglomerate rock that was these pebbles in other kind of rocks. But in any case, this turned out to be the gold mine, which they did some drilling, the first ever drilling on Mars. And what they came up with was clear evidence that there were clay minerals, which means that these were minerals that were formed in water, and that the area had at one point, and we're talking 3.5 billion years ago maybe, had not only water, but water that was the kind of thing you could drink. Hmm. And it had all the other elements that elements that are needed for life. And so at the end of this long study, they declared that this area, Yellowknife Bay, was at one point habitable. Doesn't mean it was inhabited, but it had all that it needed, all that environment needed to have life. And what's utterly remarkable to me about this and what I really love talking to people about is that the time period that they're discussing here is roughly the time that life began on Earth. So there's this real possibility. We don't know for sure, but there's a possibility that Mars and many parts of Mars had the capabilities of being a petri dish where life could begin at the same time that it began on Earth. Hmm. Kind of amazing.
So where did all that water go?
A question that has not yet been answered. Clearly, something bad happened on Mars so that it turned from being much warmer and wetter than it is now into being a place that is very dry, that's very cold, that's covered with the red iron oxide. And so we don't exactly know what happened to make all of that occur. But, you know, it went from being in an environment that might work for life to being one that probably doesn't. And the water, well, we'll get back to the water.
All right. My guest is science writer Mark Kaufman. We're talking about his book, Mars Up Close, Inside the Curiosity Mission. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking with science writer Mark Kaufman about his new book, Mars Up Close, Inside the Curiosity Mission. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Mark, we were talking before the break about the as-yet unsolved mystery about what went wrong on Mars and made all the water go away.
Right. Just to set the stage for a second, scientists have known for some time that there had been water on Mars, and sometimes there were these catastrophic floods that would make canyons, you know, that make the Grand Canyon look pretty small. So these were huge gushes of water. But there was never any firm determination that there was water that over a long period of time would flow and then kind of form into deltas, into lakes, into oceans, whatever. And in order to do that, of course, it would need to be raining periodically. And to me, the perhaps most remarkable or one of the most remarkable conclusions that they came to was that that here at Gale Crater, there was not only a stream coming down, but there was a lake, and the lake seemed to have gone through across much of the crater. And then that does leave the question of and that means that there probably was rain at the top of Mount Sharp and water coming down. I mean, really just not the kind of Mars that we imagine. And then we think, okay, what happened to it? And we do know that the atmosphere kind of fell apart maybe a billion years into its the existence of Mars. And because the atmosphere got thinner and thinner, the water started to flow off. Then it got colder and colder, and the water would freeze and then sublimate, kind of just go into water vapor and then flow off. But it gets more complicated than that because there's reason to think that there's a lot of water underground or frozen water, ice, under the Martian surface. And there have been a number – this is not associated with Curiosity per se, but there's been discoveries of many thousands of these streams, what appear to be streams, that in warm weather on many slopes turn black. And then when it gets cold, they kind of disappear. And it is not water on the surface, but it's probably – it may well be kind of salty water underneath. So the question of where's the water, still not resolved, but they're getting a lot more clues and a lot more kind of understanding that, yes, there was a lot of water.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Mark on the line, another Mark in Fort Worth. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, Mark, what is the theory for how Mars became covered in iron oxide?
Well, this occurred after the earlier phases when there were you could have the clay minerals and then the sulfate minerals, and then as it got colder and more acidic, the iron oxide then got more prevalent and now covers the entirety of the planet. One of the interesting things of what Curiosity has found so far, and this is all kind of ground truthing what had been predicted before, is that the red is this iron oxide is just on the surface. You break open a rock, and that has happened several times with the Curiosity rover wheels, and inside the rocks are kind of bluish green or grayish green. And so the red, which was a relative latecomer to Mars, is what we think of Mars as being. But in reality, it's not the red planet. It's kind of the bluish green planet.
Tell us about the comet that is headed uncomfortably close to Mars as we speak.
Yeah, comet sighting spring. This was something that was discovered a year and a half ago. And initially they thought that the comet was coming directly at Mars. And it would have been an extremely bad day had it hit Mars. I mean, we have three rovers there now, two of them working. There would at that point be five orbiting satellites. We're talking billions and billions of dollars. And if the comet came right at them, they would probably all be destroyed. So there was a great deal of consternation. They now believe it will instead come about a third, what would be equivalent to a third of the way between the Earth and the Moon, which may seem like a long way, but it's in terms of cometary passes, it is the closest one on human record. Others have occurred for sure, but this will be the closest one that we've ever seen as human beings. And it turns out that this comet is coming from not the zone where many of the comets come from, but rather it's from the Oort cloud, which is this sphere of dusty snowballs that kind of just float around in circles. And this is outside of the solar system. It's kind of the furthest outer layer of the solar system. And then every once in a while, one of these dirty snowballs will get through gravitational forces of some kind, will get knocked out of its orbit and will then start heading into the inner solar system. And that's what happened with this comet sighting spring. It is the first time that it's making a pass into the inner solar system, and thus in astronomical terms, it's called a virgin. What initially they had thought was going to be a major, major disaster is now looking to be a worrisome situation, but also one of the great science opportunities that they're going to have at Mars, where they're going to be able to observe this Oort cloud comet that has never come into the solar system, and this has never occurred before. To me, one of the interesting take-homes of this is that we really are gradually becoming a space-faring civilization. If this had happened 40 years ago, we wouldn't really have known that there was going to be a comet coming, and it wouldn't have mattered because there weren't space either assets going either circling or traveling across Mars. But now it really matters, and we also have a lot of capability to look at what happens. So it's kind of an interesting thought process of what it will be like when we're more and more of a spacefaring society.
It would surely be an awesome sight from the surface of Mars. Is Curiosity equipped to take terrific pictures facing out toward space?
Good question. And what I've been told is that the chances of it getting good pictures probably aren't great. I'm not exactly sure of all the reasons why. Probably it has to do with the fact that the cameras are designed to look down and out rather than to look up. And they may not have the capability to do that, or they will have the capability only in a limited way. The camera that's most flexible is one that is designed to look with incredible precision at very, very small things. So looking up would be a problem. However, there are these other orbiting satellites, and one of them, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, has a camera called HiRISE, and it's revolutionized our understanding of Mars because it looks at the surface and has brought home remarkable images. But it is going to be trained on what's called the nucleus of the comet, the dirty snowball, and they're going to try to get images of that, and also they'll be working spectrometers to see what kind of compounds are there. Plus, the Hubble will be looking at it, and basically every major observatory on Earth. So I think we'll probably get a lot of great pictures, probably though not from Curiosity.
Where do the images of Curiosity on the surface of Mars come from? Is it taking selfies, or are those pulled by some satellite?
No, they're selfies. They're with a little photoshopping in between, mm-hmm. Along the way. There's a camera at the end of the 7-foot-long arm that the rover has. It's called the MOLLE, and that's the one that is kind of a geologist field glass and can make small things very large. And that is the one that can, it's very mobile, it can be moved around, and it has now three times spent, I think it's 2 days, taking pictures of Curiosity, and then those pictures are all put together, and the pictures that have the arm in it are kind of faded out. So
we all need a little Photoshop to look our best in a selfie, yeah, right?
Yes, exactly.
No shame.
but they are remarkable, and they all have been taken. The three selfies so far have been taken at what are, from a scientific geological perspective, really really important spots. So it's kind of a way of putting, you know, down a flag, but at the same time making a scientific statement.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Nick in Dallas. Hey, Nick.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, since water seems to have been present on Mars, have they checked to see if there's any life that could have produced residual organic compounds?
A good question, and the search for organics is the other half of what the main missions are of Curiosity. The first was to determine whether or not Mars was habitable, and the answer was yeah. The search for the organics is really, really complicated. Organic compounds are carbon-based compounds that are, in as we understand it, the building blocks of life. And without these carbon-based building blocks, you know, it doesn't look like you're going to be able to find, you're going to be able to have any kind of life. And we know for a fact that organics fall down on Mars as they fall down on Earth all the time in terms of from asteroids, from comets, and from something called interstellar dust. So a lot of organics hit the ground. But now that the ground now that the atmosphere is so thin, it appears that the radiation that comes in destroys the organics. So the search for organics has been a really difficult task. There was a paper that came out at the Lunar and Planetary Convention down in Texas, I guess in the springtime. And in it, they said, hey, we've determined that we have found organics, they're Martian organics, but there's controversy because it's unclear whether or not there were also organics that were brought to Mars by Curiosity. But that is, it is a very key part of what they're doing, and they know that organics are there or have been there, but they're really, really hard to find because of that radiation and other things that destroy them.
Scientists are doing their best, or did do their best before the launch, to keep this thing clean. There's a photograph in the book of people in basically, it looks like, hazmat suits to keep any kind of debris that might come from this planet from traveling all the way to Mars.
Yes, definitely. But it's tough. It turns out that the cleaning that occurred when the Viking missions went to Mars, which mm-hmm. was in the 70s, was significantly more intensive than, and it's really, really costly. And then also the instruments that are being that are in Curiosity could be really damaged by that same process of trying to clean off all of the organics. So they did the best they could, and that was extremely good. But just as a for instance, the first time that they tried to detect methane, which is an organic gas, in the atmosphere of Mars, they came up with a positive, and they were really, really excited, and the news kind of, you know, leaked out. And they later had to kind of walk it back because it turned out that that was methane from Florida.
We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who says, has there been any discussion of orbiting depots between Earth and Mars that could be positioned in advance of a manned mission? My thought is that these could offer supplies for the long spaceflight and maybe even be reinitialized and diverted to land on Mars as habitats or labs.
I'm sure that that is an idea that has come up and is part of the, you know, the process of putting together an architecture to get humans to Mars. But if I could just speak to that for a second, Texas is obviously a state where human exploration looms very large. And human exploration to Mars is a great goal of this nation, but it's a goal that keeps on being, you know, kicked down the road a little bit more and more. But one of the things that I came away from in terms of the book was that the kind of work that they're doing now in Curiosity is kind of setting the stage for future human missions in terms of learning how to land larger and larger vehicles in terms of determining what kind of environments are there and the extent to which the radiation is going to be dangerous or not dangerous or can be mitigated. So to go back to the question, there are a lot of different architectures for how we get to Mars. And some of them involve going to the moon and setting up colonies and learning how to live there. Some of them involve going out and finding an asteroid and tugging the asteroid into the Earth area, Earth-Moon region, and then using that as a staging point. Others involve going to the moons of Mars and landing there, which would be much easier to do than landing on Mars. And so there's a lot of in play. And the engineers are pretty confident that these enormous problems that are there, challenges in terms of how you get to Mars and how you could get humans to survive there, they're manageable. The question is, does the population want it? Does it want to spend the money? Is this an important matter?
Science writer Mark Kaufman is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Mars Up Close, Inside the Curiosity Mission. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science writer Mark Kaufman. His new book is Mars Up Close, Inside the Curiosity Mission. Mark, let's talk about the risks to humans who might stand up and say, I am willing to put myself on a vehicle bound for Mars. One major concern simply in getting there alive and healthy enough to do their work is radiation.
Right. This is radiation that here on Earth we're protected from largely. There's a magnetic field which holds in the atmosphere and blocks out a great deal of the radiation. Once you get past that, then you're exposed to cosmic radiation and then also solar, and they could both be extremely damaging. Currently, it takes about 9 months to get for a spaceship to go from Earth to Mars. It is considered probably to be too long a time for humans to be up there in terms of the risk that they would incur in terms of radiation. It still is not like they're going to be arriving in some kind of dire straits. It's just that it will make them far more susceptible to cancers and other things in the future. But so 6 months is what they're shooting for in terms of getting a spaceship that would go faster. But then once they're on the ground, there's a little bit of atmosphere to protect them, but the radiation is still going to be a major problem. And of course, it is on a bad day, minus 120 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's a very hostile environment. And how are you going to get water there to drink? How are you going to get food there? There's a lot to be figured out. The thing that surprised me as I've gotten further into the subject is how many people are involved right now in trying to answer those questions. And some of that is NASA. Some of that is private individuals. And famously, Elon Musk of Tesla fame and SpaceX has said that he wants to go to Mars. He wants to die on Mars. But as he told me, he just doesn't want to die in a big ball of flames. He wants to die in bed. And given his track record, who knows? Maybe he will.
If we were to colonize Mars in any significant way, though, we would need to be able to have babies there.
Yes, and at this point, I mean, that is way far in the distance because there isn't oxygen, sufficient oxygen for people to be able to live. And by the way, the next Mars mission is going to look at how you can create oxygen with an eye toward both using it as a fuel and using it potentially as a way to terraform Mars in the future. But no, the idea of a colony is it's a great kind of goal, a vision, but there's a long way to go before that. I mean, first they have to do human flybys, and then they have to land. And as it turns out, the landing isn't so hard. It's the taking off again.
Right.
Which
the one-way
why,
trip.
Right. The whole idea of the one-way trip has gotten some currency. And remarkably, thousands of people have signed up for that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Linda in Grand Prairie. Hello, Linda.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have wondered about the existence of water now, no existence of water on Mars. And I've wondered, our planet has a molten center, a lot of iron in it, and the spinning of it has created a set of magnetic poles and protection for Earth from the solar winds. And if I remember my bits and pieces of science that I've heard over the years, if we didn't have that magnetic cover, so to speak, a strong solar wind could blow away part of our atmosphere and evaporate away our oceans. Does Mars have a molten center?
At one point in the early days, that first half a billion or billion years, the scientists believed that, yes, they did. And it did. And it had a magnetic field set up precisely as you described as a result of that. And then something happened. It might have been a big asteroid hit it. It might have been that the size of the planet, it's much smaller than Earth, put it out of equilibrium in terms of that molten core and the surrounding magnetic field. But clearly something happened, and that was extremely catastrophic. And it kind of raises an interesting question to me, because it turns out that on Mars the catastrophe is quite obvious, but here on Earth, actually, we are the product of catastrophe as well. It's just that the catastrophes have often had a positive side to them. And Mars teaches us many things, and one of them is that, hey, catastrophes happen.
And we're lucky that we ended up on the good side of things.
Yes, exactly.
If we were, Mark, to figure out how to do terraforming, what's the thinking about how long it would take to actually create an environment on Mars that could support human colonization without too much, gear at all times keeping people alive? Is this a 10,000-year mission?
Probably not 10,000 years, but, certainly not in our century. And the idea of having any kind of colony may not be in our century, although it could. And if I could circle back to what I was mentioning before, which is that the engineers and other life support scientists believe that most that the challenges are surmountable, and the kinds of thing that you described, that kind of terraforming, that may well be quite possible. But the question is there the funding? Is there the public support? Is there the societal desire? Is there the ability of nations to work together, because they would have to for something like this, to make it happen? And that's part of why I wanted to write this book. Just kind of a sidelight, Mars, it turns out, as photographed by Curiosity and then by some of these orbiting satellites, is beautiful. You can, and that's what I tried to convey in the book. It's a book by National Geographic, so it has tons of pictures, but it also has a full narrative. But that's one of the things that really surprised me, was that this was just a visually fascinating place. And I think in order for that desire to go to Mars to become widespread enough for people to say, hey, you know, we want our tax dollars or we want to give money for this, they have to kind of see, hey, this would be really worth doing. And that's part of what I tried to convey.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Oakley in Dallas. Hello, Oakley.
Hello, Chris. Great show today.
Thank you.
Mark, hi.
Hi.
My question is concerning hematite again, in essence. I was wondering what new information, if any, you have from the Curiosity rover or from anywhere else on the blueberries, quote-unquote, the nickname for the hematite nodules found in the Meridiani Planum area by Opportunity?
Right. This is something that there hasn't been a great deal of work done so far by Curiosity on hematite, which is this iron-based mineral. But that will change when they arrive at the base of Mount Sharp, because they're most excited about these layers upon layers of clay and of sulfates. But there's also this large wall of hematite. Again, they've never seen anything like it. And it is something that can give them a lot of clues about when the area was watery and what kind of conditions there were. But in terms of additional insight into what the blueberries were and how they were formed, that I haven't seen. It may be that I just didn't follow it, but I haven't seen that as being a focus.
We should clarify for people. Blueberries is a nickname. There's no evidence of vegetable matter of any kind.
Yes. Thank you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Shyle in Dallas. Hi, Shyle.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think you might have already answered this, but my question is, with the information that we've discovered with Curiosity about Mars, what are the next missions that we have in 10 to 20 years? I did hear that you were talking about we were trying to find oxygen on Mars or something similar to that. So just what do we have as a nation or other nations, like such as Europe or in Russia?
We've got one launch for 2020 planned, right?
That's correct. There's a 2020 launch that is going to be it'll look very much like Curiosity, but it'll have different kind of instruments in it. There also is a satellite that's just arriving right now. And its goal is to understand that upper atmosphere and how the water might have disappeared. And it's coming just in time to see this comet sighting spring, which is just an enormous serendipity. There is the InSight mission, which is a NASA mission, I think in 2 years, 3 years, that'll land and dig in a little bit. ExoMars is a European effort to put a rover onto Mars. It's a little complicated by politics now, because initially the U.S. was going to provide the rocket that was going to launch it. But then 3 years ago or so, the NASA budget was cut, and that was one of the things that had to be cut. And it's now the Russians who are going to be doing that, unless international boycotts make that impossible. But in terms of the long-term question that you ask, it's a really good one, because after 2020, there really isn't a plan. And because of the you know, the fiscal environment here in Washington, it's, you know, no one has been able to plan beyond that 2020, and it's unclear what kind of funding there's going to be. So it's, you know, there'll be in the next couple of years, there'll have to be some really tough decisions made about what kind of Mars exploration we want. And hopefully people will say, yeah, let's go for it.
When different countries work together on these international projects, Mark, do different nations have different specializations?
They have different specializations, but also what happens is that there's kind of a competition to get their instruments onto the vehicle. For instance, there is a Canadian spectrometer of sorts that is there, that's on Curiosity. Both France and Germany had done a lot working in collaboration for other instruments. The Spanish have a weather monitoring system there on Curiosity. So it's that's the way that it tends to be done. The United States does the launch and the mission control and all of that. But the instruments sometimes are then given or the right to have the instrument there is given to others. Actually, there's a Russian instrument on Curiosity as well. There isn't going to be a Russian instrument on 2020. There is going to be a Norwegian one and I think another Spanish one.
Human beings are brilliant and ambitious and curious, but fragile. So what's the advantage of putting a human being on the surface of Mars? What can a person do that the best instrumentation we can build cannot?
In terms of trying to figure stuff out, you know, there's a lot of debate about that. Is it better to do it robotically or spend the enormous sums of money to send a person there and then be able to bring them back? John Grunfeld, who's the head of science for NASA, said, you know, if I landed on Mars, I could get to Mount Sharp in a week. I could do all the tests that were done in, you know, the first 2 years. I could basically do them in a couple days. So that is part of the logic here. But also part of the logic is something that Jim Green, who's the head of the Mars program for NASA, had said recently, which is that a one-planet society, a one-planet species is doomed to extinction. And that's kind of the biggest thought in a way out there, that, you know, in the long term, you know, centuries, as we were describing for terraforming, if we don't do that, if we don't have that capability, then some catastrophe might get us here.
The new book by science writer Mark Kaufman is called Mars Up Close, Inside the Curiosity Mission. Mark, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.